I pressed my face against the grimy transparisteel window of my HAB unit, watching the endless procession of workers streaming through the arterial walkways of Hive Septimus like blood cells through diseased veins. The sight had become as familiar as the gnawing hunger that had settled permanently in my gut since the administratum's latest efficiency measures had reduced our water rations by another 15%. My name is Ordon Loke, and I had spent the better part of 23 years maintaining the servitor units in the plasma generator facility on sublevel 47 of the mid-hive. The work was honest, if mind-numbing, involving the constant calibration of lobotomized human-machine hybrids that tended the reactor cores with the same mechanical devotion they had shown in life. Each day brought the same routine: wake before the shift klaxons, consume my meager protein paste ration, and descend into the bowels of the facility where the air shimmered with heat distortion and the constant hum of plasma conduits provided a soundtrack to my existence. The water shortage had begun 3 months prior when a memorandum from the Adeptus Administratum announced that population growth in the upper spires had necessitated resource reallocation. The explanation came buried in 17 pages of bureaucratic doublespeak, but the practical result was simple enough to understand. Where once I had received 4 liters of reclaimed water daily, I now received 3.4 liters. The reduction might have seemed insignificant to someone living in the climate-controlled comfort of the upper hive, but down in the generator facility where temperatures regularly exceeded 40 degrees Celsius, every drop mattered. I had watched fellow workers collapse from dehydration during their shifts, their bodies unable to cope with the combination of reduced fluid intake and the brutal working conditions. The medical servitors would drag them away to the infirmary, and most never returned to their posts. Supervisor Kine would simply requisition replacement workers from the vast pool of unemployed masses that crowded the lower levels, treating human resources with the same casual indifference he showed toward broken equipment. The surveillance apparatus of Hive Septimus had evolved over centuries into a web of paranoid observation that would have impressed even the most dedicated inquisitor. Every corridor contained multiple picked recorders, their mechanical eyes tracking movement with tireless vigilance. Work gang overseers moved among the laborers like predators, their augmetic eyes scanning for signs of reduced productivity or unauthorized behavior. The Arbites maintained a network of informants throughout the facility, workers who had traded their dignity for slightly better rations and the promise of protection from the worst excesses of industrial life. The culture of suspicion had infected every aspect of daily existence. Workers reported on each other for infractions as minor as taking too long in the sanitation facilities or failing to maintain proper posture during shift prayers to the Omnissiah. The reward system encouraged betrayal, offering small improvements in living conditions for those willing to inform on their colleagues. Trust had become a luxury that few could afford, and friendship was a dangerous liability that could be weaponized by ambitious informants seeking to curry favor with their superiors. I had managed to avoid the worst of the surveillance network through a combination of careful routine and deliberate mediocrity. My work performance remained consistently average, neither exceptional enough to draw positive attention nor poor enough to warrant disciplinary action. I kept my head down, spoke only when necessary, and maintained the facade of a loyal imperial citizen who accepted his lot without question. The strategy had served me well for over 2 decades, allowing me to blend into the anonymous mass of workers that formed the backbone of the hive's industrial output. The breaking point came during a particularly brutal heat wave that had settled over the facility like a suffocating blanket. The plasma generators had been running at maximum capacity to meet increased energy demands from the upper levels, and the ambient temperature in the maintenance sectors had climbed to nearly 50 degrees. My water ration had been consumed by midday, and the remaining 8 hours of my shift stretched ahead like a death sentence. The coolant lines that fed the plasma generators carried reclaimed water mixed with industrial additives, creating a solution that was technically non-potable but far cleaner than the sludge that flowed through the lower hive's water reclamation systems. The pipes ran along the ceiling of the maintenance bay, their surfaces beaded with condensation that dripped steadily onto the deck plating below. I had stared at those droplets countless times during my shifts, watching precious moisture evaporate into the recycled air while my throat burned with thirst. The decision to steal water had not been made lightly. I understood the risks involved and the potential consequences of discovery. The Administratum's regulations regarding resource theft were explicit and unforgiving, carrying penalties that ranged from flogging to exile depending on the severity of the offense. But the alternative was slow death by dehydration, and my body had reached the point where rational thought was being overwhelmed by primal desperation. I waited until the third hour of night shift when the facility operated with minimal supervision. The skeleton crew consisted primarily of servitors that required little oversight, and the human workers were spread thin across multiple levels. I made my way to Maintenance Bay 7, where a section of coolant line had developed a slow leak that I had been scheduled to repair the following day. The location was isolated from the main thoroughfares and positioned in a blind spot between two picked recorder arrays. The tools required for the theft were simple ones that any maintenance worker would carry as part of their standard equipment. I used a pressure valve to create a small opening in the coolant line, allowing me to fill a standard issue water container with approximately half a liter of the precious liquid. The taste was harsh and metallic, tainted with chemical additives that burned my throat, but it was water nonetheless. I sealed the leak with industrial sealant and disposed of the evidence in the plasma furnace, where it would be reduced to component atoms within seconds. The relief was immediate and overwhelming. The liquid soothed my parched throat and provided enough hydration to complete my shift without collapsing. I told myself that it was a one-time transgression, a necessary survival measure that would not be repeated. But the next day brought the same crushing heat and the same inadequate ration, and I found myself returning to the coolant line with growing desperation. The pattern continued for nearly 2 weeks. Each theft was small and carefully planned, never enough to trigger automated monitoring systems or cause noticeable pressure drops in the coolant network. I varied my methods and locations, using different access points and timing my actions to avoid the irregular patrols conducted by the work gang overseers. The additional water allowed me to maintain my productivity levels and avoid the medical attention that would have inevitably followed collapse from dehydration. Supervisor Kine had earned his position through a combination of bureaucratic cunning and casual brutality that made him perfectly suited to manage the human resources of the plasma facility. His augmetic left eye could detect minute changes in body temperature and stress indicators, while his enhanced hearing allowed him to monitor conversations from considerable distances. The man possessed the predatory instincts of a natural hunter, combined with the administrative authority to destroy lives with a single report to the Arbites. The discovery came during what should have been a routine maintenance inspection. I had been working on a servitor unit whose motor functions had degraded beyond acceptable parameters, requiring replacement of several neural interface components. The work was delicate and time-consuming, demanding the kind of steady concentration that was difficult to maintain while suffering from chronic dehydration. I had made my usual pilgrimage to the coolant line during the meal break, consuming just enough liquid to steady my hands for the remaining hours of the shift. Kine's approach had been silent and calculated, his augmetic limbs allowing him to move without the telltale sounds of normal human locomotion. I had been focused on the servitor repair when his shadow fell across my workstation, and I looked up to find his mechanical eye focused on my face with unblinking intensity. The supervisor's expression revealed nothing, but I could see the data streams flowing across his augmetic display as he analyzed my vital signs and stress responses. The interrogation that followed was conducted with the methodical precision that characterized all official proceedings in the hive. Kine questioned me about my recent activities, my work performance, and any unusual behavior I might have observed among my fellow workers. His questions seemed random and unfocused, but I recognized the pattern of a skilled interrogator probing for inconsistencies and signs of deception. My responses were carefully measured, maintaining the facade of confused innocence while my mind raced through the possible evidence he might have gathered. The trap was sprung with devastating efficiency. Kine produced a data slate containing surveillance footage from the previous night, showing a figure in maintenance coveralls accessing the coolant line in Bay 7. The image quality was poor and the lighting inadequate, but the timestamp and location were unmistakable. He enhanced the footage using his augmetic eye, highlighting details that would have been invisible to normal human vision. The evidence was circumstantial but damning, and we both knew that circumstantial evidence was more than sufficient for administrative justice. The supervisor's report to the Arbites was filed within the hour, triggering an automatic review process that would determine my fate. The charges were specific and detailed: theft of imperial resources, violation of workplace safety protocols, and conduct detrimental to industrial productivity. Each offense carried its own prescribed punishment, but the combination was severe enough to warrant immediate termination and exile from the Hive City. The administrative machinery moved with terrifying speed once the process had been initiated. My access codes were revoked, my HAB unit was sealed, and my personal effects were confiscated as potential evidence. The Arbites arrived at my workstation with the efficiency of a military operation, their carapace armor gleaming under the harsh industrial lighting as they secured the scene and conducted their investigation. The hearing was a formality that lasted less than 10 minutes. An Arbites judge reviewed the evidence, confirmed the charges, and pronounced sentence with the same mechanical precision that characterized all aspects of Hive administration. My 23 years of loyal service were dismissed as irrelevant, my previously spotless record meaningless in the face of proven theft. The punishment was swift and absolute: immediate termination of employment, forfeiture of all Hive citizenship privileges, and exile from Hive Septimus with only the clothes on my back. The escort to the Hive exit was conducted by two Arbites officers whose augmetic modifications made them more machine than human. They flanked me as we walked through the corridors I had traversed daily for over two decades, their presence ensuring that no one would risk association with a convicted thief. Fellow workers averted their eyes as we passed, some from shame at their own cowardice, others from fear that any sign of sympathy might be interpreted as complicity. The massive blast doors that sealed the Hive from the outside world groaned open with mechanical reluctance, revealing the wasteland beyond. The air that rushed in carried the scent of industrial pollutants and the metallic tang of acid rain, a harsh reminder of the world that existed beyond the protective walls of the Hive City. I stood at the threshold between my former life and an uncertain future, carrying nothing but the knowledge that my crime had been the theft of water that would have evaporated into the recycled air within hours. The doors sealed behind me with a finality that echoed through the empty wasteland, cutting me off from the only world I had ever known. The nearest settlement was Hive Quintus, a smaller industrial complex located approximately 200 kilometers across the polluted landscape that stretched between the major population centers. The journey would take several days on foot, assuming I could find enough water and shelter to survive the crossing. The wasteland stretched before me like a wound carved into the flesh of the planet itself, an endless expanse of corroded metal and poisoned earth that bore witness to millennia of industrial excess. The air tasted of sulfur and burned promethium, each breath scraping against my throat like sandpaper, while the acrid fumes triggered fits of coughing that left flecks of blood on my lips. Behind me, the towering spires of Hive Septimus disappeared into the perpetual smog that shrouded the upper atmosphere, their lights fading until they resembled distant stars in a polluted sky. My first steps into exile carried me across a landscape that defied natural description. The ground beneath my feet consisted of compressed industrial ash mixed with the pulverized remains of countless generations of machinery, creating a surface that shifted and crunched with each footfall. Twisted remnants of ancient factories jutted from the earth like the bones of prehistoric beasts, their skeletal frameworks providing the only vertical relief in an otherwise flat expanse of desolation. The metal had been corroded by centuries of acid rain into fantastic shapes that resembled abstract sculptures, their surfaces weeping rust-colored tears that stained the ash beneath them. Navigation through this hellscape required constant attention to avoid the numerous hazards that lurked beneath the seemingly uniform surface. Chemical pools had formed in the depressions left by long demolished structures, their surfaces reflecting the sickly yellow glow of the overhead smog, while releasing vapors that could blind or kill an unwary traveler. The liquid within these pools possessed an oily consistency that suggested a mixture of industrial solvents and organic waste, creating a toxic brew that would dissolve flesh within minutes of contact. I learned to recognize the warning signs of these hazards by the way the ash around their edges took on a crystalline quality, as if the very earth had been transformed by prolonged exposure to whatever chemicals they contained. The automated defense systems that had once protected the industrial facilities remained active despite the abandonment of their parent structures. Turret emplacements emerged from concealed positions at irregular intervals, their targeting systems still programmed to engage any movement within their sensor range. The weapons themselves had suffered from decades of neglect, their barrels corroded, and their ammunition feeds clogged with debris. But they remained dangerous enough to pose a lethal threat to anyone foolish enough to trigger their activation protocols. I developed a technique for identifying their positions by watching for the telltale glint of optical sensors and the subtle geometric patterns that distinguished artificial structures from natural formations. My route toward Hive Quintus followed the remnants of what had once been a major transit corridor, its elevated roadway now reduced to scattered chunks of rockcrete that provided stepping stones across the more treacherous sections of the wasteland. The original construction had been designed to carry heavy industrial traffic between the major population centers, but the passage of time and the corrosive effects of the environment had reduced it to a series of isolated platforms that required careful navigation to traverse safely. Each jump between sections carried the risk of a fatal fall into the chemical pools or debris fields that had accumulated in the spaces between the surviving fragments. The physical toll of the journey began to manifest within hours of leaving the hive. My body, accustomed to the regulated environment of the industrial facility, struggled to adapt to the extreme conditions of the wasteland. The temperature fluctuated wildly between the scorching heat of the day and the bone-chilling cold of the night, forcing me to seek shelter in the ruins of abandoned structures that offered minimal protection from the elements. The lack of proper nutrition became apparent as my energy reserves dwindled, leaving me weak and dizzy during the most demanding portions of the traverse. Dehydration returned with a vengeance despite my recent theft of coolant water. The dry air and constant exertion quickly depleted my body's fluid reserves, while the toxic atmosphere made every breath a struggle that left my throat raw and bleeding. The irony of my situation was not lost on me as I searched desperately for any source of clean water in a landscape that had been poisoned by the very industrial processes I had spent my life maintaining. The few liquid sources I encountered were contaminated with chemicals that would have killed me faster than thirst, forcing me to continue my journey while my body slowly consumed itself in an effort to maintain basic functions. The industrial pollutants that saturated the atmosphere began to affect my skin within the first day of travel. Small lesions appeared on my exposed flesh, starting as minor irritations that quickly developed into painful open sores that refused to heal in the toxic environment. The chemicals in the air reacted with my sweat to create a caustic mixture that burned wherever it made contact, leaving angry red welts that wept clear fluid and attracted the attention of the mutant insects that thrived in the polluted ecosystem. My hands, which had been my primary tools during my years of service, became swollen and painful to the point where gripping even simple objects required tremendous effort. The respiratory distress that had begun as a minor cough evolved into a persistent wheeze that made every breath a conscious effort. The toxic particles in the air accumulated in my lungs, creating a burning sensation that intensified with each inhalation while my body struggled to extract oxygen from the contaminated atmosphere. Blood began to appear in my sputum, a dark red reminder of the damage being inflicted on my internal organs by the prolonged exposure to industrial waste. Sleep became nearly impossible as the need to breathe overrode my body's natural rest cycles, leaving me exhausted and disoriented as I stumbled through the endless wasteland. The psychological impact of isolation in such a hostile environment proved to be as devastating as the physical deterioration. The silence of the wasteland was broken only by the distant groaning of metal structures and the occasional hiss of escaping gases, creating an auditory landscape that seemed designed to drive travelers to madness. The absence of human contact after decades of constant interaction with coworkers and supervisors left me feeling disconnected from reality, as if I had been transported to an alien world where the basic rules of existence no longer applied. I found myself speaking aloud to break the oppressive silence, at first simply narrating my actions or observations, but gradually developing into extended conversations with imaginary companions. The sound of my own voice provided a tenuous connection to my humanity, but the words seemed to be absorbed by the toxic atmosphere before they could travel more than a few meters from my mouth. The realization that I was talking to myself should have been alarming, but the alternative of complete silence was far more terrifying than the admission of my deteriorating mental state. The hallucinations began on the second day of travel, manifesting as fleeting glimpses of movement in my peripheral vision that disappeared when I turned to investigate. The toxic chemicals in the air may have contributed to these episodes, but the stress of exile and the constant fear of death created a mental state that was particularly susceptible to such disturbances. The visions gradually became more elaborate and persistent, transforming from simple shadows into detailed apparitions that seemed to possess independent existence within the poisoned landscape. The most disturbing of these hallucinations took the form of imperial saints whose images I had seen countless times in the devotional materials distributed throughout the hive. Saint Celestine appeared as a figure of blazing light that hovered just beyond the range of clear vision, her presence accompanied by a sensation of overwhelming judgment that left me trembling with fear and guilt. The saint's condemnation of my theft was communicated not through words, but through a direct transmission of divine displeasure that penetrated my consciousness like a blade of pure righteousness. Saint Drusus manifested as a more traditional figure, his power armor gleaming despite the polluted atmosphere, while his augmetic eye focused on me with unwavering intensity. The saint's presence was accompanied by visions of my crime projected against the backdrop of the wasteland, showing my theft of water in excruciating detail, while emphasizing the magnitude of my transgression against imperial law. The hallucination forced me to relive the moment of discovery repeatedly, each iteration adding new layers of shame and self-recrimination to my already fragmented psyche. The parade of saints continued throughout my journey, each appearance more vivid and accusatory than the last. Saint Sabbat emerged from the chemical pools to denounce my weakness, while Saint Macharius rose from the ruins of ancient factories to condemn my failure to accept my fate with proper imperial stoicism. The collective weight of their disapproval created a crushing psychological burden that made each step forward an act of defiance against divine judgment, while their constant presence eliminated any possibility of rest or respite from the torment of my exile. The ruins of the Prometheum refinery appeared on the horizon like a metallic mountain range, its twisted spires and collapsed processing towers creating a jagged silhouette against the polluted sky. The facility had been abandoned for decades, its equipment stripped away by salvage crews, while the superstructure remained as a monument to industrial decay. The complex covered several square kilometers of the wasteland, its boundaries marked by the remnants of defensive walls that had been breached in countless places by the passage of time and the corrosive effects of the environment. My approach to the refinery was motivated by the desperate need for shelter and the faint hope that some source of clean water might remain within the abandoned facility. The outer perimeter was littered with the detritus of the evacuation, including personal effects and industrial equipment that had been deemed too worthless to salvage. The main gate had been torn from its hinges by some tremendous force, leaving a gaping wound in the defensive wall that provided easy access to the interior of the complex. The first indication of human presence came in the form of crude modifications to the existing structures, including barricades constructed from salvaged materials and primitive shelters built within the shells of abandoned buildings. The work showed signs of recent activity, with fresh welding marks and newly installed security measures that suggested the current occupants were both organized and paranoid about potential threats. The realization that I was entering claimed territory should have prompted an immediate retreat, but my physical condition had deteriorated to the point where continued travel was no longer possible. The Rust Prophets revealed themselves with the sudden efficiency of predators who had been watching my approach from concealed positions throughout the refinery complex. Their leader emerged from behind a collapsed cooling tower, his body a grotesque fusion of human flesh and mechanical augmentation that spoke of crude surgical procedures performed without proper medical equipment. The gang members who followed him displayed similar modifications, their limbs replaced with industrial machinery, while their faces were hidden behind masks fashioned from scavenged respirator equipment. The capture itself was accomplished without violence, my weakened state making resistance both futile and unnecessary. The gang members surrounded me with practiced coordination, while their leader examined my condition with the calculating gaze of someone evaluating potential merchandise. My value as a prisoner was clearly limited by my physical deterioration, but the knowledge and skills I possessed as a former hive worker apparently made me worth keeping alive despite the resources required for my maintenance. The Rust Prophets had claimed the central processing facility as their primary stronghold, converting the industrial spaces into a combination fortress and workshop where they pursued their particular brand of technological heresy. The walls were lined with salvaged equipment and crude religious icons that depicted the fusion of flesh and machinery as a form of divine transcendence. The air within the facility carried the scent of burning metal and human sweat, while the constant sound of industrial machinery provided a mechanical heartbeat that echoed through the converted spaces. My captors secured me within a holding area that had been constructed from the remnants of a chemical storage tank, its walls lined with mesh barriers that prevented escape while allowing observation of the surrounding activity. The confinement was clearly temporary, designed to hold prisoners until their ultimate fate could be determined by the gang's leadership. The other occupants of the makeshift prison included several individuals whose origins and circumstances remained unclear, though their shared condition of physical deterioration suggested they had all endured similar ordeals in the wasteland. The realization that my journey had ended in capture rather than salvation should have filled me with despair, but the exhaustion and chemical exposure had numbed my emotional responses to the point where I could only observe my situation with detached curiosity. The Rust Prophets represented a new form of threat that I had never encountered during my years in the Hive, their combination of technological obsession and territorial aggression creating a dynamic that defied the ordered hierarchies I had known throughout my working life. The holding tank that served as my prison had been fashioned from the corroded remains of what appeared to be a chemical processing vessel, its interior dimensions barely sufficient to accommodate three adult humans in a standing position. The walls retained the pitted scars of whatever caustic substances had once been stored within, creating a surface texture that felt like sandpaper against exposed skin. Ventilation came through a series of crude holes that had been burned through the metal using industrial cutting tools, allowing the toxic atmosphere of the refinery to circulate freely while providing no protection from the temperature extremes that plagued the abandoned facility. My fellow prisoners included a middle-aged woman whose work coveralls identified her as a former water reclamation technician, though the gang symbols carved into her forehead suggested she had fallen afoul of territorial disputes rather than administrative justice. Her left arm had been replaced with a crude mechanical prosthetic that sparked intermittently, the result of what appeared to be emergency surgery performed without proper medical equipment. The constant twitching of the device created a rhythmic clicking sound that echoed through our confined space, while the exposed wiring occasionally produced small electrical discharges that left burn marks on whatever surface they contacted. The second occupant was a younger man whose origins remained unclear, though his physical condition suggested prolonged exposure to the wasteland's toxic environment. His skin had taken on a grayish pallor that indicated chemical poisoning, while his breathing produced a wet rattling sound that spoke of severe respiratory damage. The gang had fitted him with a makeshift breathing apparatus constructed from salvaged components, but the device appeared to be malfunctioning based on the way he struggled to draw each breath. His eyes held the vacant stare of someone whose mind had retreated from the reality of his situation, leaving behind only the basic biological functions necessary for survival. The routine of imprisonment began to establish itself within hours of my capture. The Rust Prophets maintained a constant watch over their human inventory, with guards rotating through the facility according to a schedule that seemed designed to prevent any pattern recognition that might be exploited for escape attempts. The sentries themselves represented the full spectrum of the gang's technological obsessions, their bodies modified with industrial equipment that ranged from simple tool replacements to complex mechanical augmentations that had fundamentally altered their human appearance. One guard possessed arms that had been replaced with hydraulic lifting mechanisms, the heavy machinery grafted directly onto his shoulder joints in a procedure that had left visible scarring around the connection points. The devices allowed him to manipulate heavy objects with ease, but the constant hydraulic pressure required to maintain their function created a persistent hissing sound that announced his presence from considerable distances. His face had been fitted with a welding mask that appeared to be permanently attached, its dark visor concealing his features while providing protection from the industrial processes that occurred throughout the facility. Another sentry had undergone modifications that focused on surveillance capabilities, his skull opened to accommodate additional optical sensors that provided enhanced vision in multiple spectrums. The surgical scars that marked the installation sites had healed poorly, leaving infected wounds that wept constantly while the exposed mechanical components attracted swarms of mutant insects. His augmented eyes moved independently of each other, scanning different areas simultaneously while data streams flowed across small display screens that had been implanted directly into his temples. The observation of these guards provided disturbing insights into the gang's approach to human modification. The procedures had clearly been performed without proper medical facilities or trained personnel, resulting in infections, mechanical failures, and psychological trauma that would have been easily prevented in a legitimate medical setting. The Rust Prophets appeared to view such complications as acceptable losses in their pursuit of technological transcendence, treating their own members as test subjects for experimental procedures that blurred the line between enhancement and mutilation. The facility itself had been extensively modified to support the gang's activities, with the original industrial equipment repurposed to serve functions that its designers had never intended. Chemical processing vats had been converted into crude surgical theaters where the modification procedures took place, their interiors lined with salvaged medical equipment that had been jury-rigged to function despite obvious compatibility issues. The lighting in these areas came from industrial welding torches that had been mounted on adjustable arms, creating harsh shadows that danced across the walls while providing inadequate illumination for delicate surgical work. The sound of these procedures echoed through the facility at all hours, a constant reminder of the fate that awaited the prisoners held within the makeshift cells. The mechanical whine of bone saws mixed with the hiss of welding equipment and the wet sounds of flesh being separated from bone, creating an auditory landscape that seemed designed to break the will of anyone forced to listen. The screams that accompanied these operations were muffled by the industrial noise, but their emotional content remained clear enough to understand the suffering being inflicted in the name of technological progress. My first direct exposure to the gang's commercial activities came during the second day of my imprisonment, when a group of buyers arrived to inspect the available merchandise. The visitors wore the distinctive robes of unsanctioned tech adepts, their faces hidden behind masks that incorporated crude mechanical augmentations, while their bodies moved with the jerky motions of poorly calibrated servo motors. The leader of the group carried a data slate that contained detailed specifications for the human components they sought, while his companions examined the prisoners with the clinical detachment of livestock evaluators. The inspection process revealed the systematic nature of the flesh trade that the Rust Prophets had established within the abandoned refinery. Each prisoner was evaluated based on their physical condition, technical skills, and potential compatibility with various modification procedures. The buyers showed particular interest in individuals whose professional backgrounds provided specialized knowledge, while those who had suffered extensive physical deterioration were relegated to categories that suggested less pleasant fates awaited them. The water reclamation technician attracted significant attention due to her familiarity with filtration systems and chemical processing equipment. The buyers examined her existing mechanical prosthetic with professional interest, discussing modifications that could enhance its functionality while expanding its integration with her biological systems. Their conversation revealed plans for procedures that would essentially transform her into a living component of whatever industrial process they represented, her consciousness preserved only to provide the human intuition that mechanical systems lacked. The younger man's condition made him unsuitable for complex modification procedures, but his physical deterioration apparently qualified him for inclusion in experiments that required test subjects rather than skilled operators. The buyers discussed his potential use in trials of new augmentation techniques, their clinical terminology failing to disguise the fact that they were planning to use him as a laboratory animal. The breathing apparatus that had been fitted to his face was examined with particular interest, suggesting that his respiratory damage might actually enhance his value for certain types of research. My own evaluation focused on the technical knowledge I had acquired during my years maintaining servitor units in the plasma generation facility. The buyers questioned the gang members about my background and capabilities, their interest clearly piqued by the possibility of acquiring someone with experience in human-machine interface systems. The discussion that followed revealed the existence of experimental programs that sought to create new types of servitor units using volunteers rather than criminals, though the distinction between voluntary and coerced participation appeared to be largely theoretical. The negotiation process that determined our fates was conducted with the casual efficiency of a livestock auction, our human dignity reduced to a series of numerical values that reflected our potential utility to the various buyers. The Rust Prophets had clearly established standardized pricing structures for different categories of prisoners, with premiums attached to individuals who possessed rare skills or physical characteristics that were particularly suited to specific modification procedures. The bargaining that followed focused on bulk discounts and delivery schedules rather than any consideration of the ethical implications of their trade. The facility's workshop areas provided glimpses of the ultimate destinations that awaited the gang's human merchandise. Partially completed servitor units hung from assembly lines that had been constructed from salvaged industrial equipment, their biological components in various stages of integration with mechanical systems. The work was clearly experimental in nature, with many of the units displaying obvious design flaws that would have prevented them from functioning in any legitimate imperial facility. The Rust Prophets appeared to be learning through trial and error, using their prisoners as raw materials for procedures that had no basis in established medical or technological protocols. The organ harvesting operations represented a more straightforward commercial enterprise, with the gang maintaining a crude but functional medical facility that could extract and preserve biological components for sale to various buyers. The equipment had been assembled from salvaged medical devices and industrial machinery, creating hybrid systems that could perform basic surgical procedures despite their obviously improvised nature. The preservation methods relied on chemical solutions that had been developed through experimentation rather than proper research, resulting in variable quality that affected the market value of the harvested materials. The psychological torture methods employed by the Rust Prophets appeared to be designed as much for the entertainment of the gang members as for the practical purpose of breaking prisoner resistance. The forced consumption of industrial lubricants served multiple functions, providing both immediate physical distress and long-term health complications that would reduce the prisoner's ability to mount effective resistance. The substances chosen for this purpose were selected for their particularly unpleasant taste and texture, while their chemical composition ensured that they would cause significant internal damage over time. The exposure to toxic fumes was accomplished through a system of ventilation ducts that had been modified to deliver concentrated doses of various industrial chemicals directly to the holding areas. The gang members could control the intensity and duration of these exposures, using them as both punishment for perceived infractions and as a method of conditioning prisoners to accept their fate without resistance. The chemicals used in these procedures were selected for their psychological effects as much as their physical impact, with some substances causing hallucinations and disorientation that made organized resistance virtually impossible. The mock executions were perhaps the most psychologically devastating aspect of the gang's torture regimen, designed to create a constant state of terror that would prevent prisoners from developing any hope of survival or rescue. The procedures were elaborate theatrical productions that involved the entire gang membership, with prisoners selected at random to participate in ceremonies that appeared to culminate in their deaths. The revelation that the execution was merely a simulation came only after the victim had experienced the full psychological trauma of believing they were about to die, leaving them emotionally shattered and compliant. The evidence of failed escape attempts was displayed throughout the facility as a constant reminder of the futility of resistance. The flayed corpses of former prisoners had been preserved using chemical treatments and mounted in prominent locations where they would be visible to anyone moving through the refinery complex. The positioning of these displays was clearly calculated to maximize their psychological impact, with the most disturbing examples placed near the holding areas where new prisoners would encounter them during their first hours of captivity. The screams that echoed through the facility's corridors provided a constant soundtrack of suffering that reinforced the hopelessness of the prisoner's situation. The acoustic properties of the industrial architecture amplified and distorted these sounds, creating an environment where the boundaries between reality and nightmare became increasingly difficult to distinguish. The gang members appeared to take pleasure in these auditory displays of their power, often timing their torture sessions to coincide with periods when the maximum number of prisoners would be forced to listen to the proceedings. The systematic nature of the gang's operations became increasingly apparent as I observed their daily routines and commercial activities. The Rust Prophets had created a self-sustaining economy based on the exploitation of human suffering, with each aspect of their organization designed to maximize the extraction of value from their captives. The facility's conversion from an industrial site to a center of human trafficking represented a perversion of imperial technology that would have horrified even the most pragmatic administratum official. Yet it functioned with a terrible efficiency that spoke to the gang's understanding of both human nature and market dynamics. The realization that escape was impossible settled over me like a suffocating blanket, crushing the last vestiges of hope that had sustained me through my journey across the wasteland. The fate of those who had attempted to flee provided clear evidence of the gang's commitment to maintaining control over their human inventory, while the systematic nature of their operations eliminated any possibility of rescue from outside forces. The Rust Prophets had created a pocket of hell within the abandoned refinery, and I had become just another component in their grotesque machine of human exploitation. The transaction that sealed my fate was conducted with the casual indifference of a routine supply requisition, my human worth reduced to a series of numerical values scrawled across a data slate that changed hands between the Rust Prophets and their buyer. The tech adept who had purchased me bore the distinctive crimson robes of the Adeptus Mechanicus, though the crude modifications to his flesh and the absence of proper Mechanicus iconography suggested his status was far from official. His face had been replaced with a mechanical apparatus that clicked and whirred with each movement, while servo skulls of obviously amateur construction circled his head in erratic patterns that spoke of poor programming and inferior components. The journey from the refinery to my new destination took place within the cargo compartment of a tracked vehicle that had been assembled from salvaged parts and held together through a combination of industrial adhesives and fervent prayer to the Omnissiah. The interior reeked of promethium fumes and human waste, while the mechanical systems produced a constant cacophony of grinding gears and misfiring engines that made conversation impossible, even if my restraints had permitted speech. My fellow passengers included three other prisoners whose origins and crimes remained unknown, though their shared expression of hollow resignation suggested they understood the nature of our destination as clearly as I did. The facility that would become my final prison had been constructed within the shell of a decommissioned water treatment plant, its original purpose perverted to serve the twisted ambitions of the rogue tech adept who had claimed it as his domain. The external walls retained the utilitarian architecture of imperial industrial design, but the interior spaces had been extensively modified to accommodate surgical theaters and research laboratories that bore no resemblance to the sanctified workshops of the true Mechanicus. The lighting came from flickering illuminators that cast harsh shadows across surfaces stained with substances I preferred not to identify, while the air circulation systems carried the mingled scents of antiseptic chemicals and decomposing organic matter. The tech adept who had purchased me introduced himself through a series of binary cant transmissions that my unaugmented mind could not comprehend, though his mechanical gestures made it clear that he expected some form of acknowledgement of his authority. His workshop occupied the central processing chamber of the original facility, its walls lined with surgical equipment that had been cobbled together from medical devices and industrial machinery in combinations that defied both logic and safety protocols. The operating tables were constructed from metal slabs that had been salvaged from various sources, their surfaces scarred by countless procedures, while restraint systems of obvious improvisation ensured that subjects remained immobilized during the most invasive operations. The preliminary examination that determined my suitability for the planned procedures was conducted with a thoroughness that would have been admirable in a legitimate medical setting. The tech adept's mechanical appendages probed my flesh with instruments that measured everything from bone density to nerve response times, while his augmetic sensors recorded data that was processed by cogitators whose construction appeared to violate several fundamental principles of machine spirit appeasement. The assessment revealed that my years of maintenance work had left me with the manual dexterity and technical knowledge that made me an ideal candidate for conversion into a specialized servitor unit designed for precision assembly tasks. The surgical preparation began with the administration of stimulants that would keep me conscious throughout the entire conversion process, the tech adept's mechanical voice explaining that awareness was essential for proper neural pathway mapping during the installation of control implants. The chemicals burned through my veins like liquid fire, heightening my senses to the point where every sensation became magnified beyond normal human tolerance. The restraints that secured me to the operating table were fashioned from industrial cables that bit into my flesh with each movement, while the cold metal surface beneath me conducted heat away from my body until hypothermia became another source of torment to add to the growing catalog of physical distress. The removal of my left arm was accomplished through a combination of surgical precision and mechanical brutality that reflected the tech adept's hybrid approach to human modification. The bone saw that severed my humerus had been designed for cutting through metal rather than living tissue, its vibrations traveling through my skeleton while the blade generated heat that cauterized blood vessels even as it cut through them. The sensation of my limb being detached from my body triggered a cascade of neurological responses that my chemically enhanced consciousness experienced with horrifying clarity, every severed nerve ending transmitting its final signals to a brain that remained fully aware of the mutilation being performed. The mechanical replacement that was grafted onto my shoulder joint had been constructed from components salvaged from various industrial sources, its design optimized for repetitive assembly tasks rather than the complex manipulations required for normal human activity. The connection procedure required the installation of neural interface ports that were drilled directly into my cervical vertebrae, the tech adept's mechanical hands working with steady precision, while my spinal cord was exposed to the contaminated air of the workshop. The pain of having foreign objects inserted into my nervous system defied description. Each probe that penetrated my neural tissue creating explosions of sensation that overwhelmed my ability to process conscious thought. The integration of the mechanical arm with my biological systems required the installation of additional control circuits that were woven through my existing neural pathways like parasitic vines. The tech adept used instruments that resembled miniature versions of the tools I had once employed to maintain servitor units. The irony of my situation not lost on me as I watched him perform the same procedures I had observed countless times from the opposite perspective. The mechanical components that were being grafted into my nervous system carried the distinctive markings of various industrial manufacturers, their origins suggesting that my new limb had been assembled from spare parts intended for completely different applications. The replacement of my right leg followed a similar pattern of surgical violation, though the tech adept's growing confidence in his procedures led to increasingly experimental approaches that pushed the boundaries of what my body could endure. The mechanical limb that replaced my severed appendage had been designed for heavy industrial work, its hydraulic systems requiring the installation of additional power sources that were surgically implanted throughout my torso. The constant pressure and vibration of these systems created a new form of torture that would persist for whatever remained of my existence, while the weight of the mechanical components threw my balance into chaos that made even simple movements and exercise in conscious control. The installation of the inhibitor implants that would suppress my personality and free will represented the most invasive aspect of the conversion process, requiring direct access to my brain through procedures that bordered on lobotomy. The tech adept's mechanical fingers worked with disturbing gentleness as they inserted the control devices into my cerebral cortex, each implant designed to override specific aspects of my consciousness while leaving enough awareness intact to provide the human intuition that purely mechanical systems lacked. The sensation of having my thoughts redirected and controlled by external devices created a form of claustrophobia that extended beyond physical confinement to encompass the very essence of my being. The neural conditioning that followed the implant installation was designed to establish the behavioral patterns that would govern my existence as a servitor unit. The tech adept used a combination of electrical stimulation and chemical manipulation to create new neural pathways that would override my natural responses to various stimuli, essentially reprogramming my brain to function as a biological component of whatever industrial process I would eventually serve. The procedures were conducted over a period of several days, each session building upon the previous modifications while systematically dismantling the psychological structures that had defined my identity as a human being. The gradual erosion of my personality was perhaps the most horrifying aspect of the entire conversion process, as I remained conscious enough to observe the systematic destruction of everything that had made me who I was. My memories remained intact but became increasingly difficult to access, like books stored in a library whose catalog had been scrambled beyond recognition. The emotions that had once provided meaning to my existence were dampened to the point where even the horror of my situation registered as little more than abstract information, while my capacity for independent thought was channeled into increasingly narrow parameters that focused exclusively on technical problem solving. The final stages of the conversion process involved the installation of the external components that would identify me as a servitor unit and provide the interfaces necessary for integration with industrial control systems. The tech adept fitted me with a crude version of the cranial modifications that distinguished servitors from normal humans, though his amateur construction techniques resulted in a device that was both more conspicuous and less functional than the standardized equipment used in legitimate facilities. The weight of the mechanical apparatus pressed against my skull with constant pressure, while the exposed wiring and poorly sealed connections created additional sources of discomfort that would plague me throughout my remaining existence. The testing phase that followed my conversion revealed the extent to which the Tech Adept's procedures had succeeded in transforming me into a functional servitor unit. My new mechanical limbs responded to control signals with the precision required for assembly work, while the inhibitor implants prevented any conscious resistance to the commands that were transmitted through my neural interfaces. The tasks I was required to perform were identical to those I had once supervised as a human worker, the cruel irony of my situation providing a form of poetic justice that the Tech Adept seemed to find particularly satisfying. The facility where I would spend the remainder of my existence was a water reclamation plant that bore a disturbing resemblance to the industrial complex where my original crime had been committed. The irony was not coincidental, as the Tech Adept had specifically sought a servitor unit with experience in fluid processing systems to serve in a facility that dealt with the same basic technologies I had once maintained as a free human being. The assignment represented a form of eternal punishment that was far more sophisticated than simple physical torture, forcing me to confront the consequences of my theft through endless repetition of the same work that had once provided meaning to my life. The other servitor units that shared my workspace were products of similar conversion procedures, though their origins and the specific techniques used in their creation varied considerably. Some retained enough human features to suggest recent conversion, while others had been so extensively modified that their original species was difficult to determine. The diversity of their construction methods reflected the experimental nature of the Tech Adept's work, with each unit serving as a test case for different approaches to human-machine integration that pushed the boundaries of what was possible within the constraints of available technology and materials. The daily routine that governed my existence as a servitor unit was structured around the same maintenance schedules and productivity requirements that had once defined my life as a human worker. The tasks themselves were familiar enough that my muscle memory could have performed them without conscious thought, but the neural modifications that controlled my behavior ensured that every action was executed with mechanical precision, regardless of my internal state. The work provided no satisfaction or sense of accomplishment, existing only as a series of programmed responses to external stimuli that had been hardwired into my modified nervous system. The consciousness that remained trapped within my converted body experienced every moment of this existence with the clarity of someone watching their own life from a distance. I could observe my mechanical limbs performing their assigned tasks while my inhibited mind processed the technical requirements of each operation, but the connection between observation and action had been severed by the control implants that governed my behavior. The sensation was similar to being a passenger in my own body, aware of what was happening, but powerless to influence the outcome of any situation. The realization that this existence would continue indefinitely represented the final stage of my psychological destruction, as the hope of death or release was eliminated by the same modifications that had transformed me into a functional servitor unit. The Tech Adept's procedures had been designed to maximize the operational lifespan of his creations, with redundant systems and self-repair mechanisms that would keep me functioning long after a normal human would have succumbed to the various forms of damage that accumulated through industrial work. The prospect of centuries or even millennia of conscious imprisonment within my own converted body stretched ahead like an infinite corridor of suffering that dwarfed any punishment that could have been imposed by legitimate imperial justice. The water that flowed through the reclamation systems I now maintained carried the same chemical signatures that had once driven me to theft, its purity mocking the desperation that had led to my downfall. Each drop that passed through the filtration equipment I serviced represented a reminder of the crime that had begun my journey from respected worker to mechanical slave, while the irony of my situation provided a constant source of torment that the inhibitor implants could not fully suppress. The theft of a few hundred milliliters of coolant had ultimately cost me everything that made existence worthwhile, transforming me into a grotesque parody of the imperial technology I had once served with pride. The screaming that echoed through the chambers of my mind would continue forever, trapped within a prison of corrupted flesh and metal that had once been human. The Rust Prophets had sold me to damnation, the rogue tech adept had crafted my hell, and the Imperium's justice had provided the justification for my eternal torment. In the end, I had become exactly what I had always maintained, another component in the vast machinery of Imperial civilization, indistinguishable from the servitor units I had once pitied for their mindless devotion to duty. The only difference was that I remained aware enough to understand what I had lost, condemned to an existence that was neither truly human nor mercifully mechanical, but something far worse than either alternative could have provided.